Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear from Morning Edition's Steve Inskeep. He'll talk about the state of the NPR network after federal funding was eliminated and the role of the media in a democratic society. Immigration agents in Chicago and other areas are going to great lengths to hide their identities, including wearing masks and even removing license plates from vehicles. Many say that is a serious problem. Another Midwest state has pushed through a law prohibiting discrimination of hairstyles for black individuals. And we'll hear a spooky story from East Central Illinois. More than a century ago, there were claims a young girl was possessed by a spirit with a happy ending. We'll learn about the Watsika Wonder. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, there's been a lot of change this year. Some of that has included NPR, where federal funding has been eliminated. Morning Edition's Steve Inskeep spoke this week in Bloomington Normal, part of a WGLT event. Before that, he talked with Eric Stock, and here are some excerpts of that interview.
We're now 4 weeks into this new reality for National Public Radio following the defunding. So how are things going at NPR now?
Well, I think things are okay at NPR, as the audience here probably understands pretty well. NPR, as a national organization, was not that directly affected. The people who were really in the crosshairs were the people at local stations like yours, because local stations relied more on the federal funding, and some of the remote rural stations relied on that federal funding for a majority of the income. But I want to say that all indications that I've heard are that the audience has stepped up. We're not out of the woods yet, but I was recently at stations in my home state, Indiana. I was in the station in Indianapolis. I was at the station in Fort Wayne. And in both of those places, the audience had stepped up. They'd contributed a lot more. And that's giving the station a little bit of breathing room to figure out how to adjust their business model. A real advantage for public media is that it's never been entirely dependent on any one source. And for most stations, the largest single source of support is the people who use the service, which is kind of amazing. You and I work for a media service where people effectively subscribe for the service, even though there is no paywall. But I think the larger question is the freedom of the press, the need for us as journalists and also as citizens, which is a bigger job and a bigger right and a bigger responsibility in my mind, for us as citizens to insist on our right to gain information, to pass on that information to our fellow citizens, and to understand what our government is doing, why and how.
Is there a remedy, a prescription that is sustainable in your view? Is this spike in local support sustainable to replace what could be a permanent lack of government funding?
Yeah, well, I'm assuming it's permanent. I mean, nothing is permanent in this world, but I think it's a reasonable assumption. Mm-hmm. But here's how I look at it. We have an enormous audience. And the indications that I've seen from NPR's own figures is that the audience has grown sharply this year. Radio as a medium, like all linear broadcasting, TV is the same, is said to be in a long-term decline. Fewer people use it because more people are streaming and so forth. But even in that situation, the radio ratings have gone up sharply this year. I think people are tuning in because it's good programming and because they want reliable information in a time of tremendous news and tremendous change. Regardless of your politics, I think we can agree a lot of things are changing in America right now, and there's a lot to keep track of. So we're doing pretty well with a really large audience that is also, by the way, a digital audience. And the basic challenge for public media is to realize a little bit more income, perhaps from a little bit larger audience, to keep growing, in other words, and to keep innovating. And as I mentioned, I acknowledge that some people may not make it. There are going to be people who lose their jobs. There might be a station that closes here and there. But my hope and expectation is that we can figure out that gap and figure out the difference over time with the support of the people who use this service and who believe in a well-informed community.
And the constraints that public media and NPR have been put through now are the product of an administration that you cover as a journalist. More than a few in the administration and allies in Congress have spoken disparagingly about the media, public media, in particular, but you then have to turn around and cover them fairly, whether they are supportive of even the concept of public media or they are perhaps happy to see the defunding. So how do you hold both of those things in your head?
Oh, there are so many layers of that. But the fundamental thing is that I'm working for you. And I mean you, Eric, but really anybody out there who's listening. I'm working for the audience. That is the job. And if somebody mischaracterizes me or my job or personally insults me, I don't particularly care about that. They can say whatever they want. This free country, we have free speech. That has not been outlawed yet. And so they can say whatever they want. And I'm going to do my job for you. Often when people are saying insulting things, they're trying to distract from the thing that they don't want you to know. So it's best for me to get around that or get beyond that. I mean, really, part of the job of the press is to be resented by some people who don't want the full story out or who may sincerely feel we're not getting the full story to them. And I should be fair, sometimes the media get things wrong. I mean, there's this whole thing about people losing trust in the media, and I have maybe an unusual take on that as a member of the media. I think it's fine if you don't trust the media. I don't trust a lot of things that I read and hear and see because they're not trustworthy. I mean, if you go across the spectrum, there's a lot of stuff in the media that you really shouldn't trust. I actually wish people would trust their preferred media sources a little bit less. So I'm okay with that, and I acknowledge that. But what I want to do is deliver stories in such a way that people can, they don't have to trust me all that much because I'm citing my sources. I'm telling you how I know what I know. And I'm giving room for opposing views and other views and alternate views and not just passing on the conventional wisdom or an assumption or my initial impression, which is really what a lot of media are and what a lot of social media is, especially, is like your initial gut reaction to things. And I'm trying to be thoughtful and be credible in that way. And so you just keep going in that way, in that particular environment. And I want to name one other thing. It is true that public media have been criticized a lot. Public media are criticized a lot in political media whose business model, their profits, rely on them telling you not to trust anybody in the media except them.
This administration appears to be more hostile toward the media than even the last Trump administration, at least from the outside. Is that how you see it as well, more on the inside?
Yeah, I think that they are openly hostile in a way that has hardly been seen. And they're blatant about it, and they use government accounts to do it and government positions to do it, which I want to emphasize, that means we're paying them to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a journalist, but I'm also a citizen and I'm a taxpayer. And when somebody in government smears my work in some way, I am paying them to do that. They are using my tax dollars to attack me as a taxpayer. So I'm aware of that. At the same time, I am aware that other administrations have done the same. And somebody listening is probably shouting at the radio right now that other people have done this in different ways. Every administration has some way that they try to shape or influence the media. And so that is not unheard of. It is part of the job. Biden's administration, you will recall, was extremely sensitive to questions about President Biden's age and fitness for office. They were very unhappy about those queries, and they were not terribly open with answers. You know, there's a big debate over whether or how much they covered up Biden's true condition. My impression was that the president was, you know, making decisions. I do not see a lot of evidence that the president was like completely out of control, but he had great difficulty communicating. He had great difficulty coming across as someone who was fully in charge, and he had great difficulty getting his message out. And there was a lot of effort to somewhat diminish that or hide it in plain sight. And it finally became apparent during that famous presidential debate in 2024. So everybody has a story. Every administration has a story of their battles with the media. It's presumed, widely presumed, that the media are more liberal, or the traditional or mainstream media are more liberal, that there are more Democrats than Republicans. That may even be true, but it doesn't mean that relations are necessarily so good. I've noticed over the years that sometimes Democratic administrations and Democratic leaders may get the impression that the media are their home team. And so they have certain expectations of us, and they get very upset when they find out that we're actually reporting things independently and reporting things in a way they might not like. At the same time, Republicans have made it part of their business model to attack the media at all time, even though there's a lot of Republican media, and it's arguably some of the biggest and most powerful media in the country. Mm-hmm. But they set aside that reality and pretend to attack the media. And yet at the same time, Republicans, and I'm not the first person ever to observe this. There's a book by Timothy Snyder called The Boys on the Bus that observed this more than 50 years ago. Republicans sometimes are a little more professional and correct in their relations with the media, with news people, because they realize that it's a professional relationship and that these people are not their friends, but mm-hmm. that they have a duty to deal with them, which is something I want to say. I've just been critical of a bunch of people. I want to say I really appreciate when political figures recognize that I have a particular job in society, I have a particular duty in society. I'm a citizen and a taxpayer, so if they're an official, they're actually working for me. I may have questions, and I have questions because I have a right to have questions, and I have a right to know some answers to those questions. I really, really respect it when an official acknowledges that and knows that maybe they think I'm asking the wrong question, but they take the time to tell me why they think it's the wrong question and what they think is the right question and what is the actual answer to my inappropriate question in their view. You often do run across people who recognize what is, in my view, as a citizen, the proper order of things, and they answer a few questions from time to time.
As we continue with Steve Inskeep, you had a few questions a few months ago for Steve Bannon, a Trump ally. As you know, a lot of people had feelings about this. In the interview, Bannon says it's a time of war, not talking about Gaza or Ukraine, but about undocumented immigration in the U.S. He called them criminal terrorists and suggested that President Trump may run for president again in 2028, which, of course, the Constitution says he can't do. Can you walk us through the decision not only to interview Steve Bannon, but also to go to his home turf, his basement studio, the War Room?
Well, I mentioned that we've interviewed him this year three different times, mm-hmm. and two of them I went to his basement studio and mm-hmm. met him face-to-face. I like to meet people face-to-face whenever I can, and that's true across the political spectrum. And I like to talk to people across the political spectrum, and I really believe in that. I believe it is better for the country. It is better for our audience. It's even better for me to understand things, to talk to all kinds of people. And that means that regardless of your politics, whoever's listening to this right now, regardless of your politics, I can, I will, and I really should talk to somebody whose politics you disagree with. I recognize that there are some people, I think a little more on the political left, but now that people on the right are in power, they're doing this. But in recent years, a little more on the political left, people have said you should ignore or ostracize or isolate, not platform people that you believe to be wrong. Now, I don't think that we should just put somebody on the air to tell a bunch of fantasies or lies and not say anything about it. But I think that we should hear lots of different people in context so we understand where they're coming from. I've spoken with lots of people that Americans would find offensive. I've spoken with, depending on which American, I've spoken with Iranian leaders, including presidents of Iran. I have spoken with Chinese communists. I have spoken with Islamic militants. I remember interviewing and putting on the air a militant that I met in Benghazi, Libya in 2012, just a couple of months before the U.S. ambassador was killed in Benghazi, Libya. And we were standing by the side of the road, and I'd have to go back to look at the transcript, remember the exact context of all the interview. But in my memory, one of the things that he said he wanted was to kill Americans. And I'm an American standing right there, and he's armed, and we're having a conversation. But I think it was probably useful to have that description so that people back home had some idea of what was going on. I think it is important to talk with people across the spectrum around the world. And if I'm going to talk with people like that overseas, and generally speaking, I don't get a lot of blowback. Most people think that's, okay and understandable. If I'm going to talk to people like that, why would I not talk to my fellow Americans who have a viewpoint that you disagree with? And so I talked to Bannon. I talked to people all the way across the political spectrum. I mean, go to the other side. I've talked to Bernie Sanders. I talked repeatedly to AOC. AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has been in the very same video series with Steve Bannon. And mm-hmm. a bunch of people you would put in between them. And I would not rule out interviewing somebody farther outside, farther to the left or farther to the right of either of them as part of this series as it expands. I think that's part of understanding the country. Bannon specifically represents a slice of the MAGA movement, and he is a sometime advisor to the president. And so you talk with him and you present him in context as best you can, and you learn what you can.
An NPR poll released earlier this year showed that 3/4 of Americans consider democracy under serious threat. It's largely Democrats who think that now, but under the last Democratic presidency, the poll was essentially flipped, and Republicans said that democracy was under threat. And there are also other polls that show more young people are disillusioned about democracy and are open to other forms of government they feel are more responsive to their needs. As a journalist, how do you read all of that?
Well, I mean, I'm pro-democracy myself. I mean, I think that's an opinion that I'm allowed to have because a free society is one in which I can do my job and operate. The value of democracy, and I guess I'll speak here as a historian, is that it renews itself. When somebody gets into office and screws up, we can replace them. And if that person screws up, we can replace them. And when you look at American history, a lot of it really is a long, long process of falling forward, of everybody screwing up, but somehow the overall condition of the country gets a little bit better. That happens a lot. And that happens through a free society. And the idea of some, you know, I mean, the idea is out there. The idea of like some dictator or CEO who's going to give all the orders and be a wise ruler presupposes that this person actually is wise and presupposes that this person understands what is best for 350 some million Americans. That would be a tall order for anybody, even if they were completely sincere and deeply, deeply thoughtful and just truly an amazing person. I think it is better to have the push and pull of democracy, the push and pull of free society. I'm now thinking of a Billy Joel line. Is that okay?
By all means.
New York State of Mind, I think. I need a little give and take. New York Times, the Daily News, you know, he's been out somewhere where there's no conflict and he needs a little bit of friction back in his life. And I think there's really something to be said for that, for people who have new ideas and different ideas.
NPR's Steve Inskeep, the host of Morning Edition, he spoke with Eric Stock. A tale of the supernatural in East Central Illinois. That's ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. Two 19th century houses in a small Illinois town share a strange and haunting story we bring you this Halloween season. In the East Central Illinois community of Watseka, the Venom and Roth families lived in the homes in 1878. It was the year the spirit of a Roth daughter who had been dead for 13 years, some believe, came into the body of a Venom girl and controlled it for 5 months. To talk more about it and the houses that still stand, architecture expert Dennis Rodkin, John Whitman Brito, a current owner of the Roth House, and Neil Gibbons, owner and founder of Graveside Paranormal Ghost Tours. Sasha Ann Simon spoke with him about what's become known as the Watseka Wonder.
For full transparency, Dennis pitched this last year, right around this season, and we said, oh, maybe not. But this time around, I think it's really good to dive in. Let's go back to 1877. When it all began, Dennis, now Lurancy Venom, who's known as Rancy, had been suffering from epileptic fits and stomach problems. What else? What were the other clues and how did her family respond here?
She hears voices up above her when she's in bed. She feels breath on her face while she's sleeping. And this all starts just days after the anniversary of the death of the other girl. Mary Roth died July 5th, 1865. Mm-hmm. And it's really the night of July 5th, 1877, 12 years later, that this starts. The next day she starts talking about it. And then over the course of several months, she's got the voices, she's got breath on her face, she's having fits. And her parents are increasingly worried and want to send her to an asylum, probably the asylum in Peoria, where the other girl had died.
Right. First of all, the timing there, I mean, that can't have been a coincidence. What do you think?
Well, I think the spiritualists involved are pretty sure that it was not a coincidence. So the girl who had died, Mary Roth, the spirit who had died in 1865, had believed that she could communicate with the other dimension. When she was alive, she believed she could communicate with the other dimension. Her parents felt the same way. So no, I think the fact that a lot of this starts around the anniversary of her death is no coincidence.
Yeah, and before we bring the other gentleman in, Dennis, I'm curious how they eventually made that connection between the behavior that Rancey was displaying and that spirit of Mary Roff, who had been dead for so long prior.
You know, when you read the original article that was written about this about a year after it all transpired, and we all have copies of it in front of us right now, there's talk in town. They're going to send their daughter to this asylum. And the other family, the family whose daughter had died after she'd been in that asylum, kind of says, you know, not the greatest idea. But then over time, when the spirit of the dead girl takes over the body of the living girl, the parents, the mother and sister of the dead girl are nearby, and the living girl says, oh, there's my mom, there's my sister. The people who are not actually her family, but are the family of the girl who died 12 years ago.
And so everyone's shocked.
Yeah.
What is going on? So, Neil, I got to bring you in here because given what you do, I imagine this type of thing fascinates you.
Oh, yeah. I've been fascinated by this many years.
What stands out to you about this particular story?
Well, a lot of people, actually, I think it's a little mislabeled, is that people talk about it as the first documented possession in America, okay? Yes, it is a possession. What is actually called a walk-in, okay? A walk-in is where a spirit can inhabit a host as in body, right? It doesn't mean that it has to be a demon or anything like that. Now, we have to understand is that Lorancy Venom, just like Mary Roff, our first girl, was very clairvoyantly inclined, okay? So she had spirits coming in and out of her. She was being hypnotized by Dr. Winchester Stevens at the time, trying to help her out, and spirits are cycling through. Then all of a sudden, Mary Roff makes an appearance spiritually, what is called a walk-in. And what it is it walks into, it's a simple thing, it walks into the host body. And then it goes and identifies itself. And like he was saying, as Dennis was saying, is that notice all the family members in the house. Notice everyone around them. New family secrets and stuff, right? Knew all these things that were going on. This is more of a spiritual miracle. And I understand people want that thing that, hey, I want to talk about a possession because we've seen the movie The Exorcist and this and that.
I mean, when we talk about possession, we think of the demon kind.
Right. A lot of us, when we first start hearing the word possession, well, that goes back to The Exorcist movie. And don't get me wrong, I love movies like that, and I'm not going to knock them. I just watched the new Conjuring movie. I love all those things. But I think some of these things do get mislabeled. Is there something very supernatural going on here? Yes. Supernatural? Yes.
Yes.
Anything demonic? No.
No.
But it's still a beautiful thing that over 100 days, you get a spirit of someone who died and then inhabited a host body to help heal her. And supposedly a story goes is that, well documented, that she went off to heaven for that 100 days. And then all of a sudden, after the 100 days, Mary Roff came down. And she presented herself, said, it's time for me to go.
Mm.
And then Lorancy Venom then came back.
Herself.
And she lived a very long life, moved to California, lived a long life, had a family.
So, John, as the current owner of one of these homes, first of all, did you know all of this before you made that purchase? I'm curious.
I did. I bought the home as an agnostic 20 years ago. I thought, you know, I was moving back to Watsika from New York City. I needed a place to live. I was 40 years old. I was like, 36. And I thought I could either live with my parents or move into a haunted house that needed a total gut renovation.
So you chose the haunted house.
I did.
Over living with mom and dad.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me more about your thoughts on just the different theories that have been passed on. As we mentioned, this got national attention. At one point, there were even newspapers debating how exactly things went down.
And that's exactly the point, right? There was a debate. When I lived in New York City, I met a doctor of philosophy on Long Island who was a professor of philosophy. And he wrote about the Watsika Wonder story in his doctoral thesis because he said that the spiritualists at the time were presenting this case not as like some local ghost story, but because they were presenting what they believed was evidence for their view of the world, of what the nature of the world is, that there's this thin veil between these two worlds, between our world and some intangible world beyond us, and that we can pierce that veil through the practice of spiritualism.
So, Dennis, this is all true?
This is all reported. All of these things have been reported.
Are we still
reported.
Saying allegedly?
Well, of course, 21st century people are skeptical, but so were 19th century people. There were skeptics about this story, but some of the evidence, first of all, so she recognizes people she hasn't met.
Mm-hmm.
At one point she describes, so the Venom girl is the body, the Roth girl's spirit is in that body, and the body describes living in Texas, seeing the Red River, seeing indigenous people in Texas. The Venom girl had never been there. The Roth girl had lived there years prior.
Mm.
She finds a lace collar. This is all in this article, this contemporaneous article. She finds a lace collar in a drawer she's living in the Roth house. It's the Venom body living in the Roth house. She finds a lace collar and says, oh, this is my favorite collar that I've always enjoyed wearing. So much of this is very compelling.
Mm.
Is it true? It's very compelling.
Dun, dun, dun. If you're just tuning in, welcome. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're talking about a spooky tale that comes out of Watseka, Illinois, of spirit possession and the homes where it all happened and why this legend still lingers today. Our guests are Dennis Rodkin, who is a Crane Chicago Business residential real estate reporter, as well as In the Loop's architecture expert, John Whitman Brito, who owns one of the homes, and Neil Gibbons, who's with the Graveside Paranormal Haunted Ghost Tours. Neil, we've talked a little bit about Winchester Stevens, the spiritualist from back then. Help us understand that role, right? They're experts when it comes to the afterlife and the spirit world. What else should we know?
All right. Well, first, just so everybody knows, there's no such things as experts in this field. There isn't, okay?
Okay.
There isn't. There's only very good researchers who learn from trends in haunted locations. Anybody who tells you they're an expert at this, they're lying to you. You start to learn from a certain location, hey, this type of haunting's going on, and now I've been called to this haunting. Well, now all of a sudden I'm starting to get the same thing. So maybe now I have an intelligent haunting that's going on here because I notice the same kind of interaction going on. Or a residual haunting, which is a playback through time that does not interact with people. So maybe that's how that works. So with Dr. Winchester Stevens, I don't think there's such thing as experts, but people are going to – everybody comes to their own conclusion,
right.
If that helps them, is that they're going to come to their own conclusion about it. And in the end, he believed that, you know, this thing was really, really going on.
Right.
And the more I researched it, I really do believe that this happened. And like I was telling you, it's more of a spiritual miracle because we had our first girl, Mary Roth, okay? She was admitted into this asylum where they're in – supposedly she died in the asylum. What happens – any parent – would love to know if they can get forgiveness for the actions that took place. So if all of a sudden a parent can get a second chance at being able to say goodbye one more time, wouldn't you do that?
Mm. Well, you know, there is some interest in things like that, John. I know that you've got the house on Airbnb these days and mm-hmm. people host seances.
Yeah, people use it for family reunions, for seances, for ghost hunting. Anything and everything.
Have there been any sightings in the 20 years that you've
not
been
so
the
much
owner?
Sightings, but recordings are weird at the house. So, like, if you just want to have a relaxing week at the house, don't record yourself. Audio seems to work well at the house, right? So record it, listen back to it. You might hear voices on it. Super weird.
Dennis, let's get more into the structures here, right? These two houses, what did they look like back then versus now?
Very much as they do today. That's one of the remarkable things is these two houses that figure into this story look pretty much as they did. The one, the Venom house is the one that's a mile south of the other. It's where the girl grew up. Unfortunately, we aren't able to talk to the owner. I called multiple times. He's not interested. But it's sort of a standard small town wood frame house. Milk carton shaped with a wing off it. And it's south of the main street in Watseka.
Mm-hmm.
And then north of the main street is this brick Italianate house, the one that John owns, the one where the Roth family lived. It's had a couple of additions since that time, but it was, you know, straight sided brick house with mm-hmm. a steep roof, arched windows. Apparently had a view sort of down the street, not all the way to the other house, but she could sit in her bedroom window and look out toward the house she had come from and the house she would return to 110 days later.
Was it important to you, John, to preserve that original look and feel of the home?
Yeah, it needed a gut renovation when I bought it, and I wanted to put it back the way it was so people could experience history, experience what it was like for a Victorian in the 1860s, 1870s in rural Illinois, returned it to its original color scheme, worked with the last plasterer in Watsika to replaster all the walls, and put it back the way it was.
Mm. What's Graveside Paranormal's relationship with the Roth House today, Neil?
Oh, it's very good. We just did last year, I think that we had on October 26th last year, we had over 150 people out for a seance on the grounds.
150 people.
Yeah, which me and Larry Eisler, my buddy, we filmed it. It's going to be going out in film festival.
So what do? Just put out flyers up in the neighborhood?
Yeah,
this is coming up.
Man, come on out, man.
People just show up.
Bring your cat.
Sell tickets on Eventbrite.
Yeah. Well, no, that's what we do. We actually do. We sell tickets on Eventbrite. Everything I do, I use the Eventbrite. I love Eventbrite, by the way. Is that a small plug? Sorry.
We are not sponsored by Eventbrite.
We are not. Right. But yeah, I used that, and we had over 150 people out there, and I had Diet Renee, international media, and Diet Renee, my very good friend. We conducted the seance. And what it is for just so people understand what a seance really is, at least to me, people have a lot of baggage in life, okay? It's through spiritualism. And sometimes, like we were talking about the original story of Asa Roth and his wife Dorothy and Mary Roth, could they have gotten forgiveness for 100 days of being able to say goodbye to their daughter? If we can give that to somebody, that same kind of a feeling, and I have the medium there where she's able to do what she does with her psychic abilities, and in the end, I make you feel good, then I think we're doing something positive for a lot of people.
What do you say to, and I'd love to hear from you both on this, the people who are just skeptical of all this and they just think this is nuts? You first, John.
I mean, I bought the house as an agnostic. I'm still skeptical of certain things. I see myself more as an observer, and I respect the people coming looking for answers and respect the way that they go about it and respect the people who don't believe.
What about you, Neil? I mean, is it an educational moment or you're entitled to feel the way you feel?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I think everything that has to deal with the paranormal, the supernatural, it's educational. Like, I just took a group of people out the other day, and part of what we do on our ghost tours is I try to educate people. I actually give you out equipment during the night, and we do things, but it's also that people are curious. All people have a natural curiosity for these things, and so they're going to learn. And then maybe they'll touch into something that's in them. Once again, a lot of things that I want to talk about is positivity when I do these things.
Right.
I had an end result. I want to make sure you had a good time, and I want to make sure you walked away with that positive attitude. So I would say definitely learning process, but as well as the spiritual process as well.
Yeah, Dennis, I think the positive spin to this story is quite fascinating. I didn't expect that, I've got to say.
Isn't it? It's fascinating to think of a haunting that has a happy ending, mm-hmm. and it plays right into, I mean, I think John could market the house that way. He said people come for family reunions. Well, the first family reunion there was pretty dramatic.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and speaking of the drama, I mean, there is something that folks really just kind of fall in love with when it comes to this story as far as the details, right? Those 110 days, that's a long time for someone to be possessed by another spirit. What else do we know about what it was like just during that time for the two families?
You know, there's a fascinating moment in this original article where she's been living in the other house. The Venom girl has been living in the Roth house for nearly 110 days. And the Venom mom passes by, and the Roth dad writes in a letter to somebody, "I really feel bad for her. I feel bad that her daughter is gone from her home. But on the other hand, her daughter is in such a better condition now."
Mm, yeah.
So everybody, it seems as if at least the spiritualist family, the Roths, they felt as if this was sort of a task that needed to be accomplished. We don't have much about the emotions of the Venoms, but they did get their daughter back after 110 days.
Incredible.
And she wasn't as tormented as she had been.
for now, I'll just keep my head in the material that you all have shared with me here, because I'm just going down a rabbit hole with this story. We'll leave it here for now. Dennis Rodkin is with Crane Chicago Business. We've got John Whitman Brito, who's the current owner of the Roth House, and Neil Gibbons, who's founder of Graveside Paranormal Haunted Ghost Tours. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
You can find out more about this spooky story from Watseka at our statewide show page. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Some people may find their social circle getting smaller as they age, which could result in a feeling of isolation. But one group of seniors in Dixon is finding joy in the spotlight. Yvonne Booz explores how theater can boost morale and more.
Dixon Stage Left, known as DSL, is under renovation.
Sorry, we have lots of hazards here during construction.
Including me.
66-year-old Christine Tremaine jokes with DSL's executive and creative director, Jimmy Ferraro. They and several other adults are going over lines for We Still Got It, a variety show that includes comedy, singing, and improvisation. It's the first show for DSL Senior Theater. Group members sit around a table with paper in hand as they prepare to go over their parts. Some have performed for decades, while others are just starting out. First up, Tremaine. Tremaine pushes out the song When You're Good to Mama as she portrays Mama Morton from the musical Chicago. It's a part that she's played before.
Because the system works, the system called reciprocity.
She's been performing since she was 10. Mary Carlson is 65. She worked as a reporter and announcer at WSDR Radio in Sterling for more than two decades. She says this performance allows her to use her voice again.
When the pipes leak, when the bones creak, when the knees go bad.
Carlson says older people can benefit because it helps to keep their mind sharp. Plus, it's a good way to meet people.
I don't sing and I don't dance, but I can read. And it was just my daughter's real involved in the theater here. And she got me involved last year. I did a reader's theater group. And then I just decided, okay, I'll give this a shot.
Claire Burke is an art therapist at the Institute of Therapy Through the Arts in Evanston. She says taking part in the arts can give older people something to be excited about.
It's sad, but there are a lot of elderly people who are very isolated. They don't have many companions, or some of their friends have passed away, or they're in, you know, memory care or other things where these places might be understaffed.
Burke says older individuals need a lot of cognitive stimulation. Elmhurst University theater professor Tony Noyce and his late wife, Helga Noyce, did extensive research on how participating in theater can increase memory, creativity, and problem-solving abilities in older adults. They conducted MRIs on older people engaged in theater training and found improvements in the performance of tasks that tap relational memory as well as attentional and executive controls. Jamie Mayer is a professor of speech-language pathology at Northern Illinois University. She says the arts can do something else, give aging individuals a sense of pride.
There's also things we know that people tend to stay really good at. And so promoting self-efficacy and self-control and empowerment and pride in what you're doing is a really great way to kind of help older adults, and doing it in a social fun context, even better.
Tremaine says she suffers from severe clinical depression and bipolar disorder. She says without medication, she doesn't want to get out of bed, take care of personal hygiene, or clean her apartment.
I get up on a stage and that completely disappears. I want to share with my audience. I want to make them laugh. And that makes me happier than anything I've ever had in my life.
Ferraro says he sees it.
As soon as she came into the room, she picked herself up and she showed a radiance and a vibrance that carried all the way into her little rehearsal performance. She has purpose now. It's very exciting and heartwarming to see what could be the forgotten people to be able to have a new lease on life, and laughter and joy comes in all ages.
And Dixon. I'm Yvonne Booz.
Mama, and she is-
Missouri passed a law this year prohibiting discrimination against natural hairstyles for black people. Illinois already has a law in place. Brandon Azine went to a salon to talk more about what's called the Crown Act in Missouri.
Inside the Natural Image Hair Salon in the Hickman Mills South neighborhood of Kansas City, 16-year-old Cornelius Mitchell has just had his hair washed and is coming out from under the dryer. Mitchell has been growing his dreadlocks for about 3 years. They're black with light brown colors at the tips. His stylist is grabbing each individual lock, puffy from the blow dryer, untying and retying it for a fresher, tighter look that falls to the tip of his shoulders. His family is all about natural black hair.
My sister, she started growing her locks when she was just a toddler. And my mom has locks too. She has really long locks.
Mitchell, who plays football at the predominantly white Raymore Peculiar High School, said he gets grief from his coaches about his hair from time to time, but no one has forced him to cut it off. But he is glad the state of Missouri passed the Crown Act, legislation that prohibits discrimination based on one's hair, to keep that from happening and to protect him and his friends.
I've seen at work some of my friends, they didn't get hired just because their hair don't be maintained, or at practice it's been a lot. Just the white kids just mess with, it's usually people with afros.
In 2018, a year before this first state passed the Crown Act law, a high school wrestler in New Jersey was forced to chop off his locks or either forfeit the match. Missouri is the 28th state to pass such a law. Missouri's law bans hair discrimination in schools, but not in the workplace.
That was for Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
Anika.
Yes.
In a room with less hubbub is the salon owner LaShawn Briggs, working on locks that are smaller and more intricate than Mitchell's. She says in her 20 years of doing hair, she still hears her clients talk most about challenges of wearing natural hairstyles on the job and why they choose European styles.
I had clients who would straighten their hair out kind of often, especially I had a client who was an attorney. She would always straighten her hair when it's time to go to court, because she felt that she would look more presentable if she were to straighten her hair out.
Sitting in Briggs' chair is 59-year-old Rhonda Bean, getting her locks retwisted. Bean says she also felt pressure to westernize her look early on in her professional life.
I was hesitant to go into interview environments with my fresh new locks, although I loved them. I debated about whether I should wear a wig. In one interview, I did wear a wig, and I did not feel comfortable in my own skin.
That fear stems from her school days, when you got grief from black and white people if you didn't have straight hair. She got a lot of unwanted attention from her peers when she came with her natural look.
I would get a lot of questions from people with less coarse hair textures about my hair. How do you make it stand up the way that it does? Or can I touch your hair?
Then 10 years ago, Bean heard that there might be a connection between using relaxers and getting cancer. A 2022 report from the National Institutes of Health said that women who use chemicals to straighten their hair were at higher risk of developing uterine cancer. 4% of those women who admitted using relaxers frequently and often developed cancer twice as often as those who said they didn't. As Briggs works towards the back of Bean's hair, she says her top priority is her customer safety. She's banned relaxers from her shop.
I don't specialize in that. I don't do anything with those type of chemicals. The only chemical that we offer at Your Natural Image is color.
Not far from Bean, Cornelius Mitchell is still in the chair, having his last few locks retwisted. He says being in a salon that specializes in natural hair helps him feel closer to his cultural roots. And he's invested a lot of time and money into his locks.
To be honest, I'm at the end of senior year, I'm going to probably cut them. Going to college, just a fresh new start.
He doesn't know what style he'll adopt going forward, but he's glad Missouri has a new law in place to protect him and his friends who choose to wear their hair in whatever style they please. I'm Brandon Azim.
Immigration agents carrying out President Trump's deportation blitz are often wearing masks. Homeland Security officials say it's a matter of agent safety, but some former top U.S. law enforcement officials are raising red flags. Chip Mitchell reports.
The other day on Chicago's North Side, a crowd confronted Border Patrol agents who were trying to make immigration arrests. The agents all seemed to be wearing masks.
Gotcha. And we got your face.
Get me out of here. You! What? Show us your face! Show us your face, coward! Hey, you!
A former top Justice Department official says masks can incite public opposition. Michael Bouchard helped lead the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
When they see people coming in masks, looking like they're in Fallujah during the Iraq War, people get nervous and the tensions start to rise.
But the Trump administration says masks help protect agents' identity. On a Chicago area visit, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said assaults on immigration officers this year are way up.
Making sure that they are safe while they do this job and that they get home to their families at night, too, is incredibly important.
Still, when faces are hidden, it's harder to identify agents who are violating rights, like using excessive force.
This is all about intimidation.
Jack Riley helped run the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. He says he didn't let his agents wear masks, even when going after drug cartel kingpins in Mexico.
I also am concerned this will rub off on law enforcement in general in municipalities and cities like Chicago who are just trying to do their job every day.
When immigration agents wear masks, Riley says, it undermines the legitimacy of every other police officer. Chip Mitchell, WBEZ News.
By now, some of the Trump administration's immigration tactics are well known. Swarming federal agents, in some cases detaining people by force or breaking down doors. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers seen wearing masks over their faces. But far less public attention has been paid to the apparent masking of the vehicles that these agents are using. NPR immigration policy reporter Ximena Bustillo has been looking into this and joins us now. Hey, Ximena.
Hi, Elsa.
So what have you learned?
Over the course of the last few months, NPR investigative reporter Kiara Eisner and I have seen several videos on social media of federal officers conducting what appear to be immigration arrests. And we noticed that some of the videos shot in states like California and Illinois, vehicles appear to be driven by federal agents, but they don't have rear license plates, which are required in all states.
Exactly.
Since the start of this administration, there have been questions regarding how ICE as an agency should be operating and whether they can or should be concealing their personal identities, vehicles, or uniforms. And we spoke with several immigration advocates who say they had seen arrests made using vehicles without license plates.
Wait, but does ICE have any official regulations about this practice of hiding or not having back license plates?
Mm-hmm. ICE spokesperson Mike Alvarez told me that federal law allows government vehicles to be exempt from displaying government plates if that would interfere with their, quote, critical duties. DHS officials have previously said that their officers are seeing outsized doxing and interference with arrests, but former agency employees still see this tactic as unusual. I spoke with Darius Reeves, who was a former field office director for the ICE enforcement and removal operations in Baltimore until earlier this year.
The agency clearly wants to appear like a ghost, that there's no way that the vehicles can be, you know, tracked back to a particular field office.
ICE's policy manual says the exemptions have to be requested internally, but the agency declined to confirm how many exemptions have been requested this year. And while ICE has been the agency to get all this attention, we can't be sure yet that ICE is the one operating without license plates. The Trump administration is mixing and matching federal law enforcement agencies, bringing on people from the Department of Justice, IRS, and others to do immigration enforcement. And each has different policies and rules for how they can operate.
Okay. Well, Ximena, explain why it could be important for the public to have information like license plates.
Some advocates say that people might have different rights depending on who's making the arrest. Bruno Huizar from the California Immigrant Policy Center, an immigrant rights organization, said most people are just not used to interacting with federal law enforcement.
So people are more on high alert that federal law enforcement with their vehicles are on the streets and, you know, can protect themselves, as opposed to not knowing who this agency is and not knowing what their rights are in that circumstance.
David Beer at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, said if someone can't find identifiable information, such as a license plate, it can make it difficult to file subpoenas or other legal actions.
If you don't know the vehicle's ID information, then, you know, good luck finding the driver, good luck finding, you know, other information.
And he said that the lack of identification could result in people resisting arrests and less cooperation.
Well, going forward, do you think this tactic of obscuring license plates will continue during this administration?
Well, remember that the administration wants to hire 10,000 more deportation officers by the end of the year. And advocates warn that as more people get hired and the administration continues a fast pace of arrests, there will be more and more encounters between the public and federal law enforcement. So it's possible that we see different and more attempts to mask identities. And if it's not clear exactly who people are and what agency this is and what they should be doing, it could sow mistrust and fear.
That is NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you, Ximena.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for being with us this week. And remember to join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Statewide is available where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.